This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, was born out of the bombed-out rubble of World War II and into the Cold War. The alliance of the United States, Canada, and European nations have helped bring peace and stability to that part of the world and kept in check the Soviet Union and now Russia, to a degree. But now there are questions about the need for NATO and America's commitment to come to our European allies' defense if attacked. Here's what Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump had to say about his vision for NATO.
Do you think the United States needs to rethink U.S. involvement in NATO?
Yes, because it's costing us too much money. And frankly, they have to put up more money. They're going to have to put some up also. We're paying disproportionately. It's too much, and frankly, it's a different world than it was when we originally conceived of the idea and everybody got together. But we're taking care of, as an example, the Ukraine.
And so the Democratic nominee for president, Hillary Clinton, has a view of NATO that values the alliance, not just for European security, but for her own national security.
When he insults NATO and our Asian allies by saying basically we're going to walk away, he's putting at risk the coalition of nations we need to defeat ISIS. Yeah. He's basically making our situation worse and more dangerous.
As part of the NPR effort called A Nation Engaged, which asked our listeners to explore America's role in the world, we're asking San Antonians about their view on NATO and America's commitment and responsibility to provide military support to defend our allies. Or do you think that we are in a new age when that's not so important anymore, that nation is obsolete, or at least it needs to be reexamined and restructured? We want to hear from you. Call in 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Email us at thesource@tpr.org. Our guest this half hour, we have Jeremy Shapiro. He is with the European Council on Foreign Relations, and Ted Galen Carpenter, a senior fellow for defense and policy, foreign policy studies at the Cato Institute. And Jeremy and Ted, welcome to The Source.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
So, Ted, you wrote that NATO is an institutional dinosaur. So, it should go.
I think that we're finally having the foreign policy debate that we should have had 25 years ago, at the end of the Cold War. And what we're seeing with the political debate is that Hillary Clinton epitomizes the stale, obsolete thinking of the foreign policy establishment. Donald Trump is partially right, but largely for the wrong reasons. It's not just the financial burden on the United States that's the core problem with NATO. It is that we have undertaken obligations that involve a great deal of danger to the United States with benefits that don't correspond to justify that level of danger. It was one thing to put America's security on the line, the very existence of the United States on the line if a confrontation escalated to the nuclear level, to keep Western Europe, a crucial economic and strategic center, out of the orbit of an expansionistic totalitarian power like the Soviet Union. It is something very different to assume that same level of risk, to keep small nations on the perimeter of a conventional regional power like Russia, out of the orbit of that country. Yet that's the kind of risk that we're now incurring. I don't think the American people are aware of that. I don't think they would support it if they were aware of it.
Jeremy Shapiro, what are your views?
Well, I would partially agree. I mean, I think that the problem that we have in NATO today is that we expanded it beyond the limits of what was useful for the United States and what was and what it's frankly capable of really protecting, particularly in terms of what the American people are willing to put up with. So I very much see the points that Ted is making, but I think if you think a little bit about what he also said, which was that it was worth defending Western Europe. So now we are where we are. Now we've attached Western and Eastern Europe to together. We've created a system in NATO which is very effective at protecting it, very effective at deterring the Russians. And it would be a shame, it seems to me, to throw out 70 years worth of baby for that bathwater. So what we need to do is figure out a way in which we can adapt NATO to a lower American commitment to creating a more capability within Europe to defend themselves and to make it something that is both capable of defending Europe and doesn't create such an extreme American commitment. Now, it's fair to say that, you know, Donald Trump, I guess like a sort of stop clock is right twice a day, has a certain point that we haven't really, and again, I agree with Ted, it's not about financial burden, but we haven't really reoriented the defense burden, not just in terms of spending, but in terms of who's actually responsible for things enough to our European partners. And part of that is because we have been too ready as a country to just assume this burden for others. And that's really not something that I think we're going to be capable or willing of doing moving forward. And so we need to be renegotiating that bargain. I would not want to be renegotiating that bargain in the way that Donald Trump suggests by sort of saying, you know, we're going to leave unless you pay. It's got to be a cooperative element. But I do think that the main lesson of the last 100 years or so of history is that the security of Europe matters to the United States, and it's a good idea for us to be involved on the ground floor, and NATO is a good way to do that.
It's interesting to me.
There's a problem, though, when we insist on taking a dominant leadership role. We've seen the European allies gladly free ride on that role, not just financially, but in terms of decision making.
What do you mean free ride?
And
they don't pay. Wait. So, Ted, tell me about this free ride.
The Europeans have let us take the lead in terms of incurring risks and making the decisions. We have actively discouraged them from taking the initiative. For instance, when the troubles broke out in Yugoslavia in the early and mid-1990s, that would have been a wonderful occasion for the United States to say to the Europeans, this is a sub-regional disorder. You have no right to expect us to take the lead role in resolving this problem any more than we would have a right to expect you to take the lead in resolving a problem in Central America or the Caribbean. Instead, the United States took the lead, and we have ended up with a result
right
in both Bosnia and Kosovo that has been far less than ideal.
All right, Ted, we're taking a break. We're going to be right back after 1 minute. This is The Source on KSTX Texas Public Radio. Our line is 210-614-8980. If you want to join our conversation about the future of NATO, we'll be right back. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, KSTX 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. As part of NPR's A Nation Engaged project, we're asking about America's role in the world, particularly as a global military superpower, facing questions about the future of NATO and growing isolationism in American politics. Military City USA, San Antonio, we're one of the first to answer the call when the nation goes to war. What are your thoughts during this election year about what direction we should be heading? Our phone line is 210-614-8980. And we're speaking with Jeremy Shapiro of the European Council on Foreign Relations. He's the research director there. And Ted Galen Carpenter, a senior fellow for defense and foreign policy studies at the Cato Institute. So, Jeremy Shapiro, when we talk about a free ride for Europe in NATO, doesn't the United States only pay 22% of NATO's budget?
I mean, it depends on the way you calculate it. They pay 22% of the common NATO budget, which isn't very much money. It's not really where the defense capability of NATO comes from. If you look at defense spending, if you look at all of the defense spending of the NATO countries, the United States pays something like 70% of the total defense spending of NATO countries. And of course, that's for all of U.S. defense spending. But that's actually probably the more appropriate number. The United States is is outspending its NATO partners by a dramatic amount. And that's not a huge financial burden on the United States, it must be said, but it doesn't make any sense. And I think Ted has a point that that the burdens aren't equally shared. The financial burdens aren't the most important ones, frankly. It's the burdens of responsibility that are the most important ones, as he said.
Sure, but that's the argument that we're hearing the most often, is that the United States, and this is the one that Donald Trump is making, that this is costing America too much money. But Trump is not actually talking about reducing military spending. He's talking about expanding it considerably.
Yeah, there's no money to be saved from what he's talking about. If we withdrew from NATO tomorrow, that probably wouldn't reduce our defense spending. It might increase it, actually, because we'd have to bring a lot of troops home from Europe, and if we didn't decommission them, then they would cost us more in the United States because they are subsidized to some extent by our allies. So what he's talking about won't save us any money, and the issue really isn't money. The issue is the burden of responsibility. I think that the point, though, is that the United States has been too quick to take the lead, has not been willing. It's not just that the Europeans are free riding, it's that the United States is addicted to leadership. And so we took the leadership in Yugoslavia. We didn't even offer it really to the Europeans. And my point would be that within the context of NATO, we ought to be able to redistribute all of those burdens by being less addicted to leadership. That's our choice. And I wouldn't want to throw away everything that we've created in NATO simply because it's the only way that we can break our addiction to leadership. We must, right. In order not to take over European problems, we must not have to anything to do with them.
Not just addiction to military leadership. It seems like America is addicted to war. I'm wondering if war exhaustion, is one of the reasons why we're seeing this growth in isolationism. We have a warrior class in the United States. Certain people, certain families, certain demographics are becoming the ones who go to war, and maybe they're fed up with this. Ted Galen Carpenter.
Can we avoid the term isolationism for one thing? That's a meaningless epithet, and that's
why avoid it?
To stifle.
No. Tell me, Ted, why?
Because it really doesn't describe anything. People are developing an aversion to promiscuous interventionism in conflicts, in disputes that have little or nothing to do with the genuine security interests of the American people. And that has become an affliction that has grown worse and worse over the past 25 to 30 years. And NATO is one example of it, but it's by no means the only one. Our obsession with the intervention in the Middle East certainly is a highlight feature of that. We have an aging commitment in East Asia. My gosh, why does the United States still have a defense commitment to South Korea when South Korea has twice the population and an economy 40 times the size of North Korea's economy? If South Korea cannot build a defense adequate enough to deter North Korea, or failing that, to repel any invasion, when will it ever be ready to do so, if it can't do so now?
Well, North Korea has, well, you asked the question, North Korea has a nuclear weapon, and it's not just North Korea, as we know from the Korean War, that it's also China.
China is not about to back North Korea in a new war. North Korea has become an acute embarrassment to China. And I have spoken to a good many Chinese officials, Chinese scholars, Chinese journalists, and they almost wince when one brings up North Korea as a Chinese ally. China is not about to back North Korea in a new war. North Korea is thoroughly isolated. South Korea has the wherewithal economically to build whatever defenses it needs for its own security. It has chosen to free ride on the United States and devote its financial resources to other objectives. We have let them get away with that. And from their standpoint, their policy makes perfect sense. They get a security guarantee from a superpower, and they save a lot of money in the process.
Our phone lines are open. We invite callers. We certainly want to hear from San Antonio's military, military involvers. You know, what do you think about not isolationism, but a retraction from globalism? The number is 210-614-8980. Is NATO, does America's commitment and responsibility to NATO, does it still a top priority for us? And Jeremy, what would Ronald Reagan say about this conversation?
Well, I think it's a little bit difficult to say, actually, because I know that everybody's got a sort of image of Ronald Reagan. But the truth is he existed very much in the context of the Cold War. And in the Cold War, it was a very simple answer for him. NATO was created and intended to deter and, if necessary, fight the Soviet Union, which he believed, and I think it was a widely shared view, was a sort of existential threat worth to the United States, and it was worth motivating all sorts of resources and making all sorts of commitments to an organization like NATO in order to deter and, if necessary, defeat the Soviet Union. It's interesting to think of what Reagan would have thought about what we should do with those types of defense commitments after the Soviet Union fell. The truth is that we didn't really change very much. Because there was a sort of institutional inertia, because nothing was forcing us to change, we sort of continued NATO like the Soviet Union still existed.
Okay.
And that was a sort of strange decision, and it's led us to a lot of the places that we are today.
We have a caller, and the name is Jacob. And Jacob, hi. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to know what the panelists thought about the fact that, shortly after the Cold War ended, when the 2000s came along and Putin came into power, Russia started behaving aggressively again and pretty much justified the continued existence of NATO with its aggressive actions like invading Ukraine.
Okay, Jacob, thank you for the call. So Ted, Galen, Carpenter, Russia, the bear, aggressive.
I think Russia's actions, for the most part, have been in response to NATO's moves eastward. I mean, let's face it, the alliance has expanded right up to the frontier of the Russian Federation. And Russia has regarded that as threatening to its security. You know, that is a very different matter from the kind of messianic expansionism that the Soviet Union displayed during the Cold War, where it clearly had global ambitions and very offensive ambitions. This is the kind of defensive behavior that you expect from a conventional great power when another great power intrudes into its immediate neighborhood. We need to be more sensitive about that sort of thing.
And Jeremy?
Yeah, I mostly agree. I mean, I don't think that there's really... I don't think it exactly excuses Russian aggression. There's just no excuse for invading your neighbor, frankly, even if you do feel threatened. But I think the point is right that, it's a little bit rich to say that Russia's aggressiveness justifies NATO when Russia's aggressiveness in Ukraine, which was in 2014, NATO was hanging around for 25 years after the fall of the Soviet Union, waiting for Russia to become more aggressive. NATO was expanding right up to the borders of Russia, and Russia has always viewed and made clear in those 25 years that it viewed NATO as an anti-Russian organization, which it essentially is, and it's not surprising that they felt threatened by it, and it's not surprising that they have lashed out, and to me, that is the great lost opportunity of the post-Cold War period.
Claiborne is called in. And Claiborne, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. The Cold War never ended. The names of the players, or certain players, simply changed. One. Two, by our spending the money and them being dependent upon us for parts of this, we get to call the shots at a certain level. Like, the Supreme Allied Commander, NATO, is always a United States general. the game has not changed.
All right, Claiborne, thank you for the call. So Ted Galen Carpenter, doesn't the United States gain a certain amount of influence by being a leader in NATO?
Oh, it not only gains influence, it totally dominates the organization. I mean, cynics have often described NATO as North America and the others, and there's a good deal of truth to that.
But not just militarily, but also monetarily, you know, economically and culturally?
That translates less than we might think. I think Americans like to believe that that gives us a tremendous amount of leverage politically, diplomatically, financially. It does give us some, but let's not overrate that. What I would like to see, instead of trying to refurbish a ramshackled NATO, is to transfer responsibilities to the European Union as much as possible, security responsibilities. And you're now finding some European Union members really pushing for that. You just had the prime ministers of Hungary and the Czech Republic calling openly for the creation of a European Union army. Instead of squelching that, which we have done every time that idea has come up in the past, we ought to be receptive to it. We ought to encourage that. The European Union developing its own security apparatus, its own security responsibilities. That would be a very healthy development.
And Jeremy, you don't want to scrap NATO, you just want to revise it a little bit, right?
Yeah, I mean, I would agree that it would be great to have more European security responsibilities. I don't think that it's the United States that's been squelching the European army. I think it's the Europeans.
Okay, we're out of time. I got to go. Jeremy Shapiro, Research Director at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Ted Galen Carpenter at the Cato Institute. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be back after this NPR news break.